Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 4 of our very special series about Gallipoli. We're getting into the thick of the action now. If you haven't listened to the earlier episodes, please go back and do so, because we've done the naval battles, we've done the landing at Anzac, we've done the landing at Cape Helles, and this week we're going to talk about the hell that was the fighting at Cape Helles from sort of just after the landing until well into June and July. And joining me to do that, as always, is Peter Hart. Pete, welcome back.
Hooray. Delighted to be back. Delighted. Absolutely delighted. And we've got a lot of fighting to deal with today. And we want to make some general points about this. The fact that you have to appreciate that the main fighting is at Helles during these summer months, it's not a disrespectful slur on the Australians, who are in themselves performing amazing feats in managing to hold on to Anzac, particularly in the face of the huge counterattack in May. You can tell I momentarily forgot whether it was the 17th or the 19th. I love historians; they're so bad at dates.
Dates don't matter, Pete. Let's just keep it vague.
What do you say to that before we start, so that people get... I mean, you're Australian. How do you feel about that?
I think you're perfectly correct in what you say. Excuse me. That's the... See, I'm choking up even just talking about it. It was a deliberate decision by the Allies that they couldn't do everything everywhere. They needed reinforcements. They had to decide where they would go. And it was a pretty obvious choice that there was more space at Helles, there was more opportunity to advance, and Helles was considered the main battlefield, as we will discuss. So it's not disparaging anything that was going on at Anzac, but Anzac was specifically ordered to ease back. Don't worry about going for your objectives, just hold as many Turks as you can in place, aggressive patrolling, keep your trenches manned, grab any land that you can during this period, but the main thrust is going to be at Cape Helles. And as we shall discover during the Second Battle of Krithia, we shall talk about, also the subject of my new book, don't forget that, Krithia, they actually sent Australians and New Zealanders from Anzac to Helles. That's how important Helles was to them. So for the time being, Anzac becomes a little bit of a backwater and Helles becomes the main area of operations. Oh, I forgot our most important housekeeping thing. If you are enjoying this, you can get all the episodes straight away. You can binge them straight away by clicking on the link in the show notes and paying a small fee. You'll get all 8 episodes at once rather than having to wait for them to come out each week. So go and do that. Click on the show notes via our Patreon. Subscribe and you'll get all episodes at once. Pete, I think we're up to speed. Let's talk about what was going on at Helles.
Oh, I just want to say, yes. Wasn't that how we first met, binging on alcohol?
I think that's correct. Different type of binging. The young people these days have got a different use of the word binging. But yes, I do remember at a hotel in Canberra having a very fun first evening, and many since with you, Pete. Long may it continue.
Indeed. You're right, we better get going.
A lot to talk about.
We have. After the landings, the situation is that the British are absolutely stymied. They're stuck almost back on the beaches. And although they took 141, Hill 141, which is immediately behind the V Beach, behind V Beach on the 26th of April, that's not the spur to the advance on Achi Baba that's meant to have happened the day before. And just the process, this is a point you made, even if the landings were unopposed, getting to actually Barbara in a day would have been quite something. Because just landing a division takes time, doesn't it? I mean, there's so much to do across open beaches. There's no port, is there? There's no way decent. And remember, they didn't later in the campaign. They have sort of wharfs and quays and things, but they don't have any of that on the 26th, 27th, 28th of April, do they? It's a desert.
It was supposed to take, I think the stat was, it was supposed to take 60 hours to unload all the men and supplies, but it took them more than 2 weeks to get everyone ashore. So even just that shows how behind schedule you are. Pete, let's do something before we get started, not to go off on a tangent. Do your funny little hand thing where you talk about the geography of Hellas, because this will be important for people to understand. They're already very confused when I've said do your funny little hand thing, but it'll make sense in a minute. This will help you understand the geography of Hellas, which is really important.
I'm going to forget some of the names because I'm not prepared for this, of course. If you put your right hand in front of you, then your little finger is Gully Spur. The gap between the fingers is Gully Ravine. That's not to scale, that one.
Okay.
Then you have Fir Tree Spur, I think. Yes.
Yes, correct.
And then you have Krithia Nulla.
Yes.
And then you have Krithia Spur. And then you have Achibaba Nulla. That's got several names, but I'm going to leave it Achibaba Nulla. And then on the right, you have Kerev's Spur. Sorry, on your left, your forefinger is Kerev's Spur. And then the big gap between your thumb and the forefinger is Kerev's Ravine, the great, gigantic, blasted Kerev's Valley.
That's a really important one to point out, is that gap. Well, I'm looking at my hand now. The gap between my forefinger and my thumb is obviously very large. That's the same on the Gallipoli battlefield. So how convenient. Anytime you are walking around and you think, I must have a look at a map of Hellas, you carry one with you everywhere that you go. So
I have got
very
a more
convenient.
Complicated one for Anzac, but it does involve twisting your fingers about. Now,
Suvla Bay is just making a big cup with both hands.
That's right. they've abandoned the Kumkali French thing, so they've got to get ashore as well. And this is the great thing about the British: we get having given them the worst task on the during the naval assault on the 18th of March. They then give the French the position of honour on the right, which is facing. Well, not only does it mean that on their right flank they've got the Turks firing across the straits at them from all the batteries along there, but they've also got lying in front of them, look at your hand, the vast chasm between your forefinger and your thumb, Kerev's Dare. So they really are given the raw end of the prawn, as I believe you Australians used to say in the 1960s.
Pete, just before we get cracking on what happened in these battles as well, just talk very briefly about the objectives. What were the British trying to capture in all of this activity we see coming up?
Well, they're meant to be, they're trying to capture a place called Kilid Bahir. Now, that doesn't appear on many maps of Hellas, but it's beyond Achibaba. Achibaba is just the first day's objective, but it came
so that's
to
a hill.
Feature.
And during, that's a hill, isn't it?
It's a hill. And it comes
not much of a
to,
hill.
To, not much. It dominates the Hellas Peninsula. It is tactically important, but it does not mean you've got any view whatsoever of behind the forts at Control and Narrows. That is Kilid Bahir. Here, that is a plateau, and you've been up it. You moaned like buggery.
It's true. It's true.
Why do we have to come here? Oh, I'm tired. Oh, I might have been doing that, but it's a big plateau, and it entirely dominates the fort. That is their real objective, but you don't hear much about that for the rest of the Hellas fighting
because they don't get anywhere bloody near it.
They don't get anywhere near Achibaba. Do they? And this is, we'll perhaps talk about it, this is where objective creep. They start to talk about a village called Krithia, which is where your middle fourth, it's in your middle of your hand.
We might move away from the hand analogies now. It's starting a little vague.
Look at your map.
But the village of Krithia, the key objectives for all of these.
Not an important place.
It's not a spoiler to say all of the carnage we're about to describe was in the hope of capturing the little village of Krithia, which had been pretty smashed anyway, and the hill not far from it called Achibaba. These are the objectives for the first day. We should remind everyone, the first day objectives, these are. Okay. Let's crack on. So what did the Brits do next?
It's just going to be continual battles. I mean, if anybody thinks there's not enough fighting in our podcast, there is. We're going to have to skim through them. The French get ashore. The 29th Division is to their left. So there's 87th Brigade on the left, 88th Brigade in the middle, 86th Brigade are the reserves, and on their right are the French. On the 27th of April, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they begin to advance. It's not a big advance towards Achi Baba that you might have hoped or wanted if you were a general. It's just they just move forward, and they form a line from just above S Beach diametrically across to Gully Beach. It's not important. What are the Turks doing now? What are the Turks doing? Are they fiddling about, or are they being slightly more purposeful?
Well, interestingly, the Turks had actually fallen back after the shock of the landings. They realised on the first night that they were not going to be able to hold against successive British and French advances. So they had been pulling back. They realised that the high ground in front of Krithia, that was the place for defence. And so the Turks had been doing two things at once. They'd been pulling back towards Krithia and also getting reinforcements coming from the opposite direction to pad them out. So when Pete was describing his hand and the gullies and ridges, you might have gotten an idea that it was pretty rough country. That is absolutely correct. You will hear people talk about the plains, the sun-dappled meadows of Helles. Don't be mistaken. Helles is... It's not like Anzac, where there's cliffs and gullies and washaways leading straight into the sea, but it's tough country. It's difficult to advance. It's uphill all the way from the British and French perspective, and the Turks are looking out at them every inch of the way from the heights of Achi Baba. So this is going to be pretty tough country, and the Turks throughout this were, it wasn't quite a fighting withdrawal, but it was certainly pulling back with purpose and leaving snipers and marksmen out in front to just really hamper any British advance.
So the next thing is they've got a bit further. On the 28th, they're going to fight the first Battle of Krithia, and already the objectives have started to change. They're starting to look at taking Krithia and a hill just to the left of it first, and then swinging round and taking Achi Baba next day. I'm choking up now at the thought of what's going to come.
Yeah, with good reason.
But the Turks are not actually in trenches at this point. They're in ditches. They're makeshift trenches, and this is going to be an advance to contact. In fact, the next two battles, first two battles of Krithia, are both advances to contact. And what do soldiers hate? Whether it be the Vietnam War, any war, they hate an advance to contact because the other side get to fire first because you don't know where they are.
So it's basically deliberately walking into an ambush, isn't it? We know the enemy's out there somewhere, so we'll keep walking forward until they start shooting at us, and then we'll know where they are. It's not fun. If you're the first blokes in the line, it's not fun.
Now, the first Battle of Krithia is hardly a battle. The staff work is appalling. Remember that that most of the people who passed staff college had gone off to join their battalions at the start of the war. They were killed at Mons and in the retreat and in the fighting on the Western Front. The staff are inexperienced. And you'd mention it, the gullies running across, down, they cut up the advance, making it difficult to maintain contact. And if you think about Gully Ravine, it is a hell of a ravine. If you're trying to keep contact with people on one side in it and the other side, it's difficult. There's even a panicked retreat. The advance is pathetic. It depends what you expect from soldiers who don't know what they're doing. And by now, Turks are beginning to arrive. And there's even a panicked retreat at one point. There's a counterattack on the French, and the British 88th Brigade, they call it conforming. What they mean is they ran away as well. And at the end of the day, they end up just about a mile short of Y Beach, which they'd taken on the first day.
To our Helles Landing episode, they'd captured and abandoned Y Beach on the first day, and here they ended up almost near Y Beach again.
Well, just a mile away.
It's a mile away. That's a long time at Gallipoli.
We lose 2,000 casualties. The French lose 1,000. The Turkish reserves have arrived by this time. And the road to Achi Baba, always a bit fictitious, is barred.
There's a couple of things I just want to throw in here, Pete, about the first battle. Firstly, it's very generous assessment to call it a battle. A battle is normally two roughly equal, sized enemies fighting against each other. This was just basically an advance into machine gun fire. But the other thing we should always stress here is the lack of artillery is essential in any understanding of what went wrong at Gallipoli, because we had a combination of things. The huge delays in unloading meant that not enough guns were ashore. The difficulties with trying to drag the guns up the beaches. By this stage, the mules and the horses who'd been locked in the holds of ships for weeks or possibly months, they were lazy and out of shape and they didn't want to pull the guns. Just confusion. They couldn't get the guns ashore. And then when they did, they didn't have enough artillery to fire them, because without going off on too much of a tangent, the shell crisis of 1915, because of how quickly the war had kicked off and how quickly it had grown and the nature of modern fast-firing artillery, the factories couldn't keep up with the supply of shells required to the guns. And so the situation was pretty bad in France. In fact, it toppled the government eventually, the shell crisis. It was very bad in France, but at Gallipoli, it was absolutely farcical. They just had no shells. They had something like, I think, I'm trying to do the comparisons that I put in my book, but a battle that was launched on the Western Front at about the same time as these battles of Krithia, they would have chewed through the entire shell supply in 20 minutes. That was the entire amount of shells they had at Gallipoli, not that they were using in an attack, that they had it completely available. So very few guns, no shells to fire from them, and no idea where the Turks were because they were in scattered posts in front of their main line.
So, I mean, you've got shortage of shells. If you don't know where their enemy are, it's ridiculous. You can't slather the whole of in front of you with shells because you haven't got them. The French used to joke. The French had plenty of shells, of course, because they're not stupid, and they equip their armies for war. We don't. The French said we were one shot a day. That's what the British, you know. They were joking. But so the first Battle of Krithia, what happens next is the baton, if you like, is handed to the Turks. And what begins then is a series of the Turkish plan was always a tripwire. Well, they'd done more than trip them; they'd bloody smashed them. But they'd let them ashore, if you like, see where they land, counterattack, and drive them into the sea, kill them all. A very simple plan. And this begins. They got a force of about 21 battalions, 17,000 men, it's estimated, at Helles. And they launch a night attack, night to avoid the fire from the fleet. And they launch that on to 2,200, divide by 3, 10 o'clock at night on the 1st of May. And you're going to give a quote from Sergeant Dennis Moriarty. Moriarty. 1st Royal Munster Fusiliers.
Here's what he has to say. They crept right up to our trenches. They were in their thousands, and they made the night hideous with yells and shouts, Allah, Allah! We could not help mowing them down. Some of them broke through in part of our line, but they never again got back as they were caught between the two lines of trenches. Some of the best men in the regiment killed. When the Turks got to close quarters, the devils used hand grenades, and you could only recognise our dead by their identity discs. My God, what a sight met us when day broke this morning. The whole ground in front was littered with dead Turks. To my left, where the attack was strongest, I think there are at least 500, and there's no chance of burying them, because as anybody who shows themselves outside is bound to be brought down by one of their snipers.
Now, funnily enough, the worst attacks are actually on the French, on the right of the line. This is true.
There's a theme being established here, Pete.
I'm afraid so. By this time, a second brigade's come ashore, the Colonial Brigade, which so there's a Metropolitan Brigade, the Colonial Brigade. They're both to the right of the 29th Division. They hadn't had time to dig in properly. Of course they hadn't. And can you imagine thousands upon thousands of charging, screaming, bayonet-armed Turks coming out of the night at you? It must have been awful. And many of them bolted. And they get, actually, some of them even get, the Turks even get as far as the hill above Espich and looking down on Morto Bay. But come the dawn, who rescues the situation? Who would rescue the situation come the dawn?
That's a good question.
You know this.
Who would that be, Pete?
I'll answer my own question. It's the Navy.
Of course.
Once they can see, they can pour their shell fire. And the Turks are in the open. And the whole, the Turks are forced back. The French are a mature military. They don't fight to the last. They're like the Turks. So they fall back, organise themselves, and then counterattack, which is what most people would do in circumstances where there's we don't do this much.
I just want to say here, Pete, we talk a lot about, we should absolutely always talk about what a brilliant job the Turks did in defence, but these night counterattacks demonstrated that it wasn't a failing of the British that they were struggling to advance. It was just a combination of terrain, machine guns. Advancing in this country against a determined enemy on either side was a terrible idea. And it didn't matter. This applied at Anzac as well. You know, anywhere that anyone left their trenches and tried to get across no man's land, they were met by a torrent of fire and got cut down in their thousands. British, Turkish, yeah. Australian, French, anyone.
And they didn't learn the first time, so this is another the theme that I know you're going to develop. that if you first you don't succeed, well, they do. They try again. They try again on the night of the 3rd of May, and let's just say that they're slaughtered. They make some progress, but then exactly the same happens. The counterattacks, the Navy come back in. French and, by the way, it's the Royal Navy and the French have their own ships, of course.
This is the push and pull, isn't it, Pete, of what we've been talking about. We use that analogy of a gambler sitting down at the table and not having enough of a stake. This is the same thing for both sides. The Turks have to deal with that as well, that they can pull in reinforcements quicker than the Allies can, but now they've gone and squandered probably 10,000 of them in these night attacks, and you know, and then all of a sudden maybe it swings back to the British briefly for the numerical superiority. So it's never a level line that just progresses. There's dips and troughs, and sometimes the British are on top or the Allies are on top, and sometimes the Turks are on top. And this was a foolish decision by the Turks. This obsession with driving the Allies into the sea cost them, you know, probably a third of their strength at Helles.
It did.
Just when
they
needed it most.
But the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, Hamilton's men, are also in a terrible state. 29th Division by this time, and this I know you don't like me using technical terms, but I'm going to use it. They're buggered. They're absolutely buggered. They're exhausted, and elements of them are demoralised. No disrespect to them. Anybody would be bloody demoralised.
They're not sleeping either, are they, Pete? That's the thing. It's not like at night time you get to lie down and have a cosy nap. Even when the Turks aren't counterattacking, they're trying to improve their positions. They're digging in, they're carrying up ammunition. If the horses and mules aren't carrying ammunition and food, the men have got to do it. There's no sleep at night time. So by the time we get to 27th, 28th of April, we're talking 4 days without proper sleep for these men. So, you know, horrific.
Horrific. And the Royal Naval Division has been split up. One brigade's been sent to help out at... Because the Anzac Corps is suffering. A brigade of them is sent to help out there. So the R&D split up. It isn't a division. It's got no artillery. And basically, they're in a what we call arse and elbow, the inability to tell the difference between the two situations when it comes to military skills. They are not a competent formation at that time. The French 1st Division's already had severe casualties, and the 2nd Division hasn't even landed yet. So Hamilton needs more troops. This is where your analogy is so brilliant. The gambler sat at the table, decides to reach into his back pocket. And his back pocket is Egypt. So he sends for the 29th Indian Brigade and the 42nd Division from Egypt. But he's got another place he can get some people from. And that is, once it's stabilised at Anzac, he gets the New Zealand Brigade and the 2nd Australian Brigade from Anzac and moves them down to Helles, ready to be part of a match-winning thrust towards wherever. I'm not even going to bother.
And this is the key to my book that is coming out. I might have mentioned this before. My goodie book.
Have you got
enough? I mentioned.
Have you got a book? What's it called? What's it called?
I think it is called Krithia, and it is about Krithia. It's actually about the second battle, which we're about to describe. But just because I've been up to my eyeballs in this, I just want to make a few points here. We say they move two brigades from Anzac to Helles, so that just gets sort of stated. Everyone just throws that around willy nilly. Oh, they move two brigades down. A brigade is supposed to be about 5,000 men, but by this time they're probably at half strength. So 4,000 to 5,000 men at full strength. They're down now to about 2,500 due to casualties and attrition. So they picked the two strongest brigades, which were the 2nd Brigade and the New Zealand Brigade, and sent them down to Helles. So loosely 5,000 men they sent down to Helles. There were only 5 brigades at Anzac, and they sent 2 of them away. This is the moment when the whole campaign could have just come crashing down for the Allies. They reduced their strength by 2/5, 40%, and it's just extraordinary. The assumption that Anzac was now safe, and because we've turned our attention to Helles, you know, they can spare all the men. It's just ludicrous, Pete. It just goes on and on. It's backward thinking. It's hopeful thinking. Oh, we'll get the Anzacs down, and that'll sort everything out. It's just ludicrous.
It is. And the plans that were drawn up, they're drawn up at the instruction of Hamilton. This is not Hunter Weston's idea. It's Hunter Weston's plan, though. And the plans are shit. I don't know what you want to say. We've talked about Hunter Weston before. He is a bright man. He had a brilliant record up to Gallipoli. He's brave. He's arrogant. He's bombastic. He's an absolute arse, if you want to use the technical British term for him. But he's not stupid. But his plans are stupid.
Why does he come up with these plans? I suppose he doesn't have much of a choice. You've simply got to advance. But he takes an already difficult situation and he makes it ridiculously overcomplicated.
He does. I mean, the plans that there are the French. So what are his plans? Well, basically, it's a general advance. First, the French will advance to Kerevsdere. That's the big ravine that lay in front of them. Then act as a pivot while the British wheel round. This is wheeling in front of the Turks, who we don't know where they are still. Remember, this is also an advance to contact.
I don't know if you've ever spoken to any soldiers, Pete, but they really love the concept of walk forward towards the enemy, and then when you get close, turn half right, so they're now shooting into your flank.
Well, they just don't do. They yeah, don't they, do it.
It's not going to happen. It's ridiculous. It'd be hard enough to do that on a parade ground, trying to coordinate that on a battlefield. So people shooting at you. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely, and they're meant to wheel and take Krithia and this hill, Yazid Baba. Yazid Tepe. I can't remember being on that before attacking Achi Baba.
There's another one for our next trip, Pete. Another one for our next trip.
Look, hey. Well, I believe we're organising one for 2025.
We are indeed. Watch this space. If you want to come with us to Gallipoli, watch this space.
Should we start with the French? This is what Lieutenant Henry Fuel, he's 52nd Battery, 30th Regiment of their French artillery. And this is a murderous quote in the sense of he's just watching what happens. And you can imagine him just going, what's going on? He says this: in perfect order, our troops shook themselves out and set out to climb up the long spur which separated them from their enemies, no man's land. They advanced as on an exercise, our brave troops, no gaps in the ranks, punctuated by flashes of bayonets and the blue glint of the rifles reflecting the rays of the midday sun. You would think they were on a training ground. There you are, this is the advance to contact, then the contact. But what is there to say? This wall of steel stops, hurls itself at an obstacle that it can't breach, hesitates, immobile for an instant. Then all the geometric lines fall apart, groups running right, left, thrown into confusion, all the while Turkish machine guns rattling away, tearing at the air, ceaselessly firing into a wall of palpitating flesh. Wow. And by this time, the Turkish machine guns are starting to arrive. The Germans have lent them some. I think they arrive next day. I can't quite remember. But they're starting to arrive. And the Turkish machine guns are now in the line. So it's a slaughter. And the attacks, we don't need to say anything else.
Pete, just something about that quote, a couple of things about that. The blue glint of rifles reflecting the rays of the midday sun. Why in God's earth did they not advance at night? Who can say? Why? Why?
They got lost.
It was a decision that was discussed briefly and dismissed, that the men were too inexperienced and too leaderless and they would get lost and it would be too confusing. We have to advance. We have to stick to banker's hours and advance. And these advances are beginning at 10 or 10:30 in the morning. It's nicer than to give the Turks time to have their breakfast and a cup of tea, you know, oil their machine guns, bring up some ammunition and then kick off. It's a very civilized way to fight a war.
And the fact is, the French aren't the only ones to fail. Everybody fails all the way along the line here. They make a little tiny bit of progress, but fundamentally, as soon as they reach where the Turks are, they stop and often recoil, fall back. Trivial French gains. The attack's an utter failure. What does Hunter Weston recall? You're the expert. Your book, Krithia, is coming out. What does Hunter Weston do?
He says, this isn't going to work. Let's pack up and go to Egypt and then regroup and go to France and fight the real war.
Oh,
is that what he says?
No, it isn't. What does he say?
He says, let's do it all again. Let's do it again. It was just luck that was not on our side, Pete. It wasn't machine guns or gullies or the glinting midday sun. It was just a bit of poor luck. Let's get at him again.
The next day, 7th of May, there's more of the 42nd Division, inexperienced Lancashire territorials coming. They've been in Egypt. They start to come ashore. It's another... We haven't got time for it because it's so much like the first one.
The only key point I want to make about this, Pete, is there's something really important, and I've heard you make this point many times, so I'm going to steal it and make it myself. You've got... Just imagine the situation. So on May 6th, you've got troops that advance. They advance as far as they possibly can, and then they dig in. Those troops are now exhausted and decimated. They cannot continue the attack. So you've got to send new troops in to carry on the advance. But these new troops are in the rear area, and now they've got to get up to where their mates have dug in full view of the Turks. In full view of the Turks, they have to advance from the rear area to the new front line. And a huge and horrifying proportion of the casualties occur just in trying to get to the new front line because they're advancing in daylight. It's bloody murder, isn't it? It's just moving forward in daylight. Imagine getting shot down in the same ground that your mates had crossed the day before you even get to your front line. Just absolutely horrendous.
It's true. And after the failure of the second attack, the second day, what does he do then? Well, we could go through our jokey bit again about what does he do next, Matt? Well, he does it... I nearly swore there, Matt. Nearly swore. Don't want a children's guidance thing on it. He does it again. And he orders a third attack for 10:30 again on the 8th of May. And this is where the two brigades from the Anzac Corps really suffer. And you're going to... And also they go in stages so the Turks can concentrate. It's only a small peninsula. You're going to be Private Cecil Malthus of the Canterbury Battalion. And they're advancing along Fir Tree Spur. And, oh, boy, what happens to them?
Cecil was one of the key characters in my book that I followed because he wrote a fantastic account of his experience at Krithia and throughout the war, and just a very articulate man, school teacher, very articulate man. This is what he has to say about May 8, the day that will live in infamy for the Anzac Brigades. In perfect order, our troops shook themselves out and set out to climb up the long spur which separated them from their enemies. Nope, wrong. I shall cross the page. That's the French guy. Just wanted to make sure everyone's paying attention. Cecil said, for
Matt,
200 yards...
that was worthy of my mistake last time. I bet you edited it out.
We're a professional outfit here. I'm reading this, okay, this sounds familiar. Professional outfit.
I bet you edit that out, though.
Never. This is what Private Cecil Malthouse had to say. For 200 yards, we sprinted, thinking oddly how beautiful the poppies and daisies were. Then, from sheer exhaustion, we rushed to ground in a slight depression and lay there panting. We had kept about 10 yards apart, but soon the spaces were filled by those of our mates who managed to get so far. Now the storm was let loose and increased every moment in fury until a splashing, spurting shower of lead was falling like rain on a pond. Hugging the ground in frantic terror, we began to dig blindly with our puny entrenching tools. But soon the four men nearest me were lying, one dead, two with broken legs, and the other badly wounded in the shoulder. A sledgehammer blow on the foot made me turn with a feeling of positive relief that I have met my fate, but it was a mere graze and hardly bled. Another bullet passed through my coat, and a third ripped along 2 feet of my rifle sling. Then the wounded man on my right got a bullet through the head that ended his troubles. And still, without remission, the air was full of hissing bullets and screaming shells.
Wow. That's a great thing. It is a great book, and if I think you've chosen well to feature him in your book. Hamilton, again, what does they do? Well, the 10:30 attempt, that follows has failed, so he orders another general advance for 17:30. And to be honest, that there's only one unit that really manages to go forward and try properly, because all along the rest of the line, everybody is in a state of chaos. But one unit comes forward out of the reserves, and it's the Australian 2nd Brigade. And you've actually, I know when you do your tours, you sometimes follow them through almost from the beach.
Oh, yeah. When we do our yet-to-be-mentioned tour of Gallipoli, Pete, one of the things we do, we'll definitely be taking people on that walk. The approach walk is one of the best things you can do on a battlefield, from V Beach, following in the footsteps of the Australians, all the way up to where they received these orders. Can I just say, incidentally, the attack was timed for 5:30. They received the orders at 4:55. To the entire brigade, you have to tell 2,500 men to attack, and you've got 35 minutes before I need you to be advancing. It's just ridiculous. It was Charles Bean considered that no other attack in the war was organised in such haste as the 35 minutes that the 2nd Brigade got.
It was
got.
Madness from start to finish. And this attack is the one where... Why at 5:30? Why not 3 hours, 4 hours later when it's dark? And this is what Lance Corporal Eric Moorhead, 5th Victoria Battalion, says. The noise was terrific and shells burst in hundreds over the enemy's position. Then came the order, prepare to advance in 10 minutes. We were to advance in fighting order, each man taking a pick or shovel. Spent bullets began to drop and men were hit before we began to move. The bombardment ceased and we began the mad rush across the open, pelted by rifle and machine gun fire and shrapnel. No formation was kept and our objective appeared to be utterly unknown to officers and men alike. And that's the point. And they end up, there's some slight argument as to whether they end up in the original front line that the British were already holding, or whether they actually get forward a little bit further. The point is that when it comes to night, they do get forward. And this attack is, if ever the Australians have reason to be cross with the British, I think this attack, and the New Zealanders, by the way, this attack is, I mean, don't get me wrong, British generals at Gallipoli do it to the French and the British as well. But these two brigade attacks are almost just criminally incompetent.
Just wasteful, weren't they? And we won't get too bogged down on the Second Battle of Krithia, but suffice to say, in addition to my book coming out, I've also done a YouTube live on this only last week. So look on our YouTube channel, which is Matt McLaughlin History. Look on that for a live discussion about the Second Battle of Krithia, which I also saved as a podcast. So if you listen to the Living History podcast, which you are currently listening to, there is an episode that you can listen to all about the Second Battle. So we won't get too bogged down. But suffice it to say, as you say, Peter, it's criminal, sending in one brigade at a time as well. So they send one brigade in on one spur, that gets mown down. So they send another brigade on another spur. So the New Zealanders and the Australians got absolutely slaughtered.
And about
50% casualties they suffered in this advance, both brigades. Just horrific.
They don't take any ground from the Turks. They just take ground in front of the Turkish outposts and early trenches. And they could have occupied it at night. This is not a case of taking Turkish trenches. This is a case of just moving forward.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A British battalion came in that night. So after the Australians had lost 1,000 men in this advance out of their 2,500, a British battalion came in that night to relieve them and advanced across exactly the same field, past all the corpses at night, and did not suffer a single casualty to come up and relieve the Australians in the frontline trench. Just, they should have been advancing at night. It's so frustrating.
Let's hear from the man responsible.
The man responsible for all this slaughter. And so this is his cable that he sent to his commander, Kitchener, back in London. The result of the operation has been failure, as my object remains unachieved. The fortifications and their machine guns were too scientific and too strongly held to be rushed, although I had every available man in today. Our troops have done all that flesh and blood can do against semi-permanent works, and they are not able to carry them. More and more munitions will be needed to do so. I fear that this is a very unpalatable conclusion, but I can see no way out of it.
Yeah, and he's also lying, because trench lines. You don't imagine trench lines like on the Western Front. This is still an advance to contact, fundamentally.
Fortifications, semi-permanent works, too strongly held, scientific. That's absolute rubbish. The Turks were hiding from clumps of gorse and riverbeds and The Allied attack didn't even get close to the Turkish main line. There wasn't even much of a Turkish main line this early in the campaign, and we didn't get close to it. We were cut down long before we got anywhere near the Turks.
Now, we're going to have to crack on. Kitchener responds by sending 52nd Division. Now, they're Scottish territorials, a fine body of men, but not particularly well-trained. That's not enough. Basically, that's just replacing. And this happens time and time again.
Again, when the gambler, chase your losses, big loss, get some more in there. All you're doing is barely keeping up with the game. You're not getting ahead.
And during the next month, you get all the trenches that Kitchener's talking about. Hamilton's talking about start to appear. And there do appear proper trench lines across Helles. and you can imagine them up. Like, you've got to think of them as evil, like the James Bond villain with a cat on their knee, sitting on Archie Barber watching, going, "And what is your next move, Mr. Hamilton?"
The one thing I was amazed about, Pete, without distracting too much from this is the point between the second and the third Battle of Krithia. I did not realise how quickly the campaign changed. It was on the, I think it was the 9th of May that Hamilton sent out his order ordering the men to dig in and saying that we will now, it'll be now like semi-siege warfare rather than the big advance we'd previously seen. So I knew that the Gallipoli campaign got bogged down, but I didn't realise it was only 2 weeks after the landing that there was actually official orders going out saying, okay, we're not going to be doing the big advance, let's just dig in. Just extraordinary.
It is, the whole thing.
Third Battle of Krithia.
Oh, well, it gets a bit like the Battles of the Isonzo until the British realise and start changing their names to date. Somehow, and I don't know how, Hamilton, Hunter Weston and General Damard, or is it Gouraud by then? No, it's Damard, the French general. They convince themselves that it's worth having a go. This is the gambler analogy. They'll have another go. Nothing's changed, except the Turks have got stronger, better dug in, more troops in. And Hunter Weston's plans for 8th Corps, because by now it's a corps, 29th Division, 42nd Division and the RND, which is now united. They're not stupid, the plans. I told you, he's not stupid. But he's been ordered. And once you've taken away the absolute lunacy, the stupidity, if you like, of trying, he tries his best. And given the inner... I mean, let's go through what is... I mean, what first point would you make about what's not stupid about the plans?
I think that at least they were going to try and destroy the trenches as best they could this time around with artillery. So that was a big change. The bombardment before the first battle, I think, was 15 minutes. So this time they're actually going to use their guns to good effect to try and soften up the Turks before they advance.
They're going to use most of their ammunition in doing it as well. I mean, this is a real strain on the resources. But a four-hour preliminary bombardment. They've also got a cunning plan. Now, cunning plans never work in warfare, as a rule. They're going to stop the guns at 11:20 in the morning. And then they thought the Turks would man their position and show where the machine guns were. Yeah, they do. But there's no follow-up bombardment of any strength to take advantage of it. They also decide to have an armoured attack. Tell me about this. I know you like armour.
I don't want to laugh at these poor blokes that got wrapped up in this, but they had a fleet of Rolls-Royce armoured cars, which would drive up the Krithia Road and blast their way into the village. Now, I mean, do me a favour. I mean, we'll post some photos of this, but if you're listening to this, go and look up right now a picture of a Rolls-Royce armoured car in the First World War. It is a lumbering, heavy, slow-moving, ridiculous-looking beast. And, you know, the precursor to tanks. And unsurprisingly...
With wheels.
Yeah.
Exactly. With wheels.
With wheels, yeah.
What's going to be across the road?
Trenches. Trenches. They may have dug some trenches by now. Interestingly, I don't think the Turks were anticipating that they would use those trenches to stop armoured cars the way that the Germans would later in the war with their trenches and tanks. But they still worked bloody effectively against rickety old Rolls-Royce sedans.
Now, we've got to look at the battle that happens, and we've got to sum it up quickly, yeah. Because it's mostly disaster except for one really brilliant the brigade in the Manchester's 42nd Division, their brigade. Let's sum it up quickly. On the left, 29th Brigade stormed forward along Gully Spur and up the gully, slaughtered. It's dreadful, honestly. 29th Division attack along Fir Tree Spur. It's not only the New Zealanders that attack along Fir Tree Spur, I can assure you. Result? Well, they do as best they could, but mainly they're slaughtered. The armoured cars fail.
Unsurprisingly.
The 42nd Division had not done very well just 4 weeks before at the second Battle of Carinthia. But by now, they've done well. They've gained in experience in the trenches, which is weird, but they had. They've matured. They've got the experience. And the attack by them, well, let's do that. I want to feature them. I nearly always feature the Royal Naval Division. But as so many people have said in the past, bugger the Royal Naval Division. No idea what subtext that's got. But let's talk about the Manchester's 127th Brigade. And I've got a wonderful quote. Can you imagine it? As the clock's ticking down there. And we've talked about this before. It's the last minute motion getting to me. The last seconds, if you like, of hundreds of men's lives trickling away. And this is Private Jack Gatley of the 1st 7th Manchester Regiment. He says this: "We could see through periscopes that their front line is bristling with machine guns." That's an exaggeration, but just one is bristling for me. Meanwhile, we are issued with extra iron rations. Also, a triangular piece of polished tin to fix on our backs so that the sun flashing on these shows where we are to the artillery and staff observers in our rear and enables them to follow our advance and also distinguish us from the Turks, who wear uniforms the same colours as ours. Only the headwear is different. Nearer and nearer creeps the 0 hour, and everyone's in a nervous state of excitement, which shows in various ways. The waiting is a terrible strain. We're given our usual tablespoonful of rum. We have still half an hour to wait for the whistle. Our guns now increase their fire. Again, the enemy follows suit until there's only 5 minutes to go. Then our guns lengthen their range to behind and between the Turks' first and second lines. 3 minutes to go, and I whisper a short prayer and feel quite calm now, and many farewells and promises are made to inform each other's wives or mothers in case anything happens. 1 minute to go, and an order to get ready, and the whistle goes. We scramble up and over the top into a withering machine gun and rifle fire with shrapnel bursting overhead. Wow. And that's the moment of truth.
Sends chills up your spine, doesn't it?
It does. And here's a quote from you. You're going to read what Private Ridley Sheldon. Now, he's close alongside. He's in the 1st 6th Manchester Regiment.
It's an amazing quote too. "I shall never forget the moment when we had to leave the shelter of the trenches. It is indeed terrible, the first step you take, right in the face of the most deadly fire, and to realise that at any moment you may be shot down. But if you are not hit, then you seem to gather courage. And when you see on either side of you men like yourself, it inspires you with the determination to press forward. Away we went over the parapet with fixed bayonets, one line of us like the wind. But it was absolute murder, for men fell like corn before the sickle. I had not gone more than 20 yards beyond our first trench, about 60 yards in all, when I was shot through the left leg, about 5 inches above the knee. At once I realised what had happened, for it seemed as enough someone had taken a red-hot gimlet and suddenly thrust it right through my leg. I dropped immediately and could go no further."
Wow. Now, just up the line, Private Jack Gatley, he's a bit luckier, and he gets across no man's land. He gets ready to leap down into the Turkish front line. And there, it's just an awful hand-to-hand battle, if you like, going on there. He says this: "It was a shambles, and the slaughter was terrible on each side. And here we were at a disadvantage, as the enemy were using bombs with deadly effect, and we were being blown to pieces. This drove us into a frenzy of rage. We went at them like madmen. They nearly drove us out as they were 3-1, but we rallied, and at last we drove them out and had captured the trench and many prisoners as they were scrambling out. I caught hold of one that was carrying a flag on a long stick. He was almost over when I jumped at him and grabbed the end of the stick and tried to pull him down. Suddenly he broke away and, dropping his flag, levelled his rifle straight at my face. I thought I was done for, but I got the first shot in, and he fired as he fell with the flag under him. I took the flag as a memento. It was a near thing for me." That's wow. Another amazing quote. I love Jack Gatley. It's great quotes from him.
Good stuff. Very good stuff.
Now, they've managed... they've done fabulously well, the 127th Brigade. This is the only success of the day. They break through about 1,000, 1,200 perhaps yards, and they take almost the last organised Turkish trenches that are viable anyway before the outskirts of the Carinthia village. It's not far in front of them. What an achievement. Now, something then goes terribly wrong. Do you want me to describe it, or do you want to pick up the story?
No, you carry on, Pete. It's gripping.
Well, next in line... next to the right of the 42nd Division is the Royal Naval Division, and they launch the 2nd Naval Brigade into the attack. They do well as well. They take two. They're getting better as well. They take two Turkish lines, but on the right, the French have got an impossible objective. They've got the Valley of Death, which comes off the Caraves d'Air. They've got these huge redoubts. Some of them are still there. You can see them on the ground. The Haricot, I baked bean, but the Haricot redoubt and the quadrilateral. And it's impossible to get forward. They get shot to pieces. Because they fail, the Turks then feel away along their own front lines and take the Royal Naval Division, who have gone further on, from the side, the flank, and from behind. Royal Naval Division retreat. Not their fault. They end up in their own front line. And then, oh, no, no. And they start to press in on the 42nd Division. And it's just a question then, can the 42nd Division hold on? Can they, Matt? Can they?
I hope so.
No, they can't. And this is Private Jack Gatley again. Some of these quotes are... one of the quotes I don't like reading. It is almost emotional. Anyway, this is what Jack Gatley, 1st, 7th Manchester Regiment, said. They're trying to hold on. He says, we are consolidating our position and securing dugouts to take many more prisoners that are hiding in them. The whole trench is a shambles with dead and dying. Limbless trunks are lying all over the place and the bottom of the trench is running with blood, which we have to move about in. Arms, legs and heads are strewn about and being added to every minute by shells from the front and bombs from the right. This is the Turkish counterattacks feeling their way from the along the trenches. We searched for the dead and wounded and took all bombs from their haversacks and used them on the right. Wounded were lying about, groaning in pain until taken away to the dressing station. And you've got to remember that behind them, there's no communication trenches. What's behind them is open ground. It's the old no man's land.
That sort of fighting where you've... I think it must be, in my accounts, it must be some of the most horrific accounts I've read, is when you actually succeed. If you break into your enemy's trench, there is a whole world of horror that awaits you trying to secure that trench. It's just every account. Read about Bulacor, read about Fromelles, read about here at 3rd Krithia. It's just horrific. The enemy are closing in on both sides. You're desperately trying to pull down sandbags from the parapet to build a block in the trench. And when we say bombs, we mean hand grenades. There's hand grenades being thrown over. Hand grenade is the perfect weapon in the confined spaces of a trench like this. And it's just some of the most horrific fighting you will think of. And really, it's a test of nerves, isn't it? It's which side can hold out in the horror long enough.
Yeah, it's just awful. And this next quote is probably one of the most unpleasant quotes I'm aware of. And it's Jack Gatley again. He says, we're parched with thirst. The position here is terrible. What few men are left are spaced out, but at some distance apart with less chance of being hit. Lieutenant Hamilton and a few men started to fill all the spare sandbags we carried, and with these built up the gap, making a sandbag barrier between us. But a lot of men were lost in doing so. But it eased the strain for a while. But they started lobbing bombs over amongst us and did terrible damage as we had no more to reply with. So we caught some bombs as they came over and returned them. A fellow named Rawlinson, who was hit by a bomb, it exploded under his chin and blew the whole of his face off from ear to ear, and it hung down on his chest. The poor chap walked about, groping his way and making an awful groaning noise until someone placed an empty sandbag over his head and led him away. He died before night. It is a sight that lives in my mind still. I mean, that, actually, I remember when I first saw that, and I just thought, can you imagine that chap? Blinded, obviously, his face is off. He doesn't know what's happening, and his face is hanging down, and then they put a sandbag on his head, and he's led away. And I would imagine, I'm not absolutely certain he wasn't shot by his own side to put him out of his misery. And I've been to look at, and I'll show you, we'll read this quote and I'll show you his name on the Hellas Memorial to the Missing. Because you look at it, because I found him, and you just think, wow, what an end, what a way to go. The Manchester's just about hold on to the Turkish front line, not to the second and third lines. The Turks just can't get through. And you've got that fighting, you said. And the method of doing it, bombs follow immediately by the bayonet men. What a... Now, 5th of June, Who's winning? Who's directing? Who's in control of the battle? Is it our brave British lads preparing ourselves for another attack? Or is somebody else controlling the battle?
Well, sadly, I don't think it is anymore, Pete. I think the Turks absolutely have the upper hand now. It's a question of when, not if, they will drive the British out of those trenches. And as you say, there's no neat communication trenches behind them to get back. I mean, what a choice you'd have to make. You're in the middle of this horrific fighting. When you decide finally to leave those trenches, it's a mad dash back across no man's land, absolutely swept with fire. It's you know, success is more dangerous than failure in this environment.
Yeah. It is if you don't have the proper reserves. And this is a classic example of a gambler who's put too much down and can't follow up when it actually comes, you know, you run out of money. You can't meet, I'm not good at gambling, but you can't meet your obligations.
Well, they were too stretched, weren't they? What this says is they were too stretched. As we said at the start, they threw everything in. They threw all of their artillery in. They threw every troop they had into the front line. And so now they've got a small success, but they can't exploit it. They've got no reserves to come up. They can't even get engineers up to dig communication trenches, and they don't have enough artillery as they would do on the Western Front in later battles, where they would box off an area so that Turkish reinforcements couldn't arrive either. They just can't do any of this because they've used all their resources in that initial attack, and they've got nothing left.
And even our own trenches are blocked with the wounded trying to get back. It's just awful. One of the French, after the battle, when it finally dies down, we're left with just a little bit that Manchester's have managed to take, a trench or so. The Allies are now in a dreadful position. And I love this quote. It's a French staff officer. And he says it like it is. This is, and you're going to read Captain Francois Charles of the French headquarters. What does he say?
Theoretically, our situation is untenable. I'd say that if we were on peacetime manoeuvres, the exercise umpires would have adjudicated that we were all dead. This is the logical consequence of our troops living under the crossfire of Turkish batteries firing from Archie Barber to our front and the Asiatic coast to our rear. Yeah. There's a pseudo-French accent there, just to give it a little exotic flavour.
Yeah, yeah. After what you've said about our accents. it's just hopeless. They're still, nothing's changed. The 52nd Division, when it arrives, it just restocks the ranks. They're in exactly the same place as they were before the
battle. How many times can
battle?
We keep saying this, Pete? It's just yes. Go into the line, attack, do no good, everyone gets slaughtered, bring in more men. What do we do this time? Oh, let's go into the line and attack again. It just gets repeated over and over and over again. It's horrific.
And
there's no outflanking on the peninsula either, of course. It has to happen over the same ground because you're fighting on a peninsula. This isn't the Western Front where you can put one attack in at the Somme and the next one in at Ypres. This is a skinny little peninsula. It's only a dozen kilometres across. You have to keep attacking in the same spot, and the Turks are just getting stronger and stronger.
Yeah, and we suffer. The British suffer 4,500 casualties, and the French a further 2,000. It's a dreadful battle, and the Turks lose more because they counterattack for the best part of 2 days, they're no better at attacking, as you very rightly pointed out, than we are. And the question is this: would a 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th Battle of Krithia have any different results? Would anything change? And the answer to me is no. But the generals, they just can't seem to. They think if they maintain a continuous pressure, eventually those foreign chappies will just give up. They won't have the toughness and mental stamina that we British and French have. But they do come up with another plan.
I do want to say about the generals, just as a slight concession to them, there were only two options. Either attack and burst your way through and succeed, or go home. Like, what are you going to do? Or sit there and wait till the Turks die of old age? I mean, what are you going to do? They only had two options: pack up and leave, or keep pushing forward. They should have packed up and left.
They decide instead they'll gather all their artillery resources, which are mainly French, and we go to bite and hold, full bite and hold. They just localise attack, bite off a small chunk of the Turkish line, and then actually, as you suggest, use a wall of shells to box it off, to hold back the Turkish counterattacks. Now, we've not got time for the first one of these, although it's very important, because as ever, the French, they initiate the attack. They've stopped calling it the Battle of Krithia. They call it the Battle of the 21st of June. That's because it was, guess why they picked that title?
Because it was on the 21st of June?
Oh, I can't fool you. Who says The French attack on a front of just 650 yards, and they're aiming at Haricot and Quadrilateral redoubts, and the trenches overlooking the Ravine de la Mort. Probably a bad thing, Ravine de la Mort, a bit like Morto Bay.
The Ravine of Death. Great start.
Yes. The French have loads of ammunition because they're a proper grown-up country when it comes to war. And they spend 30,000 shells in that one battle. They take the Haricot Redoubt, but not the Quadrilateral. The Quadrilateral is the one that's still there, Matt, that we visited last time we were there.
I found one of the most incredible things I've ever found on a battlefield there, Pete. A fired, probably French, revolver projectile from a pistol.
I remember that.
How incredible. You only... I think it was French, and a Frenchman fired this from his pistol. You only fire your pistol if you are at very close quarters. So, you know, just imagine if that could speak, that little projectile. And I'm talking about the actual bullet that came out of the pistol. You know, who did that hit? What was going on? Were these the last moments, the desperate last moments of some poor French officer before he was overrun? Or just amazing. That's so indicative of close quarter fighting.
Or was he shooting a prisoner?
Or was he trying to get a wine bottle open that had a pesky cork?
Now, the British decide to try this as well. We got less guns, so we tried in the Battle of 28th of June. Concentrate their guns, and we attack along Gully Spur. It's up Gully Ravine, along Fir Tree Spur. And we have some 77 guns and howitzers, and we fire 16,000 rounds, which is, you know, is this half what the French fired, almost? But it's also half of the total British ammunition at Helles. This is the point you made.
Yeah.
And they also don't have enough to actually do a proper bombardment on the right on Fir Tree Spur. So there's another brigade going to be slaughtered there. But it is successful in the gully and on the Gully Spur. This is what Private Daniel Joyner, 1st KOSB, King's Own Scottish Border, says. While waiting underneath the parapet, it was torture. Hell! The sensations felt, going over the parapet, expecting to be hit anywhere. Awful! But as soon as you realise you're over safe, you lose all such thoughts and feelings. Mad! Men are falling right and left, they hardly notice. One thought only exists, the first trench. It is almost impossible to remember afterwards whether you walked, ran, crawled or flew over the intervening ground. The South Wales borders have reached the first line and are engaging the enemy. We're soon with them and materially assist them. Allah! Allah! The Turk cries as he puts his hands up, while another tries to bury himself in the ground, out of reach of our bayonets. Others kneel and fire until a magazine is discharged, then try to run away. They are soon all accounted for, and the first line is ours. And it is a great success on Gully Spur. But on Fir Tree Spur, this is the point I want to make. It's not just Australians and New Zealanders who suffer. Because, the 156 Brigade of 52nd Division, they try and advance without a proper artillery bombardment, and they are slaughtered. And I still remember the quotes I put in my book, Gallipoli. Sorry, just a bit of a plug there.
Yeah. Jumps. Go out and read it. Great book.
The quotes there are just harrowing. As people and it's the same thing as for every nation, but they've trained together. Some of them went to school or worked together, and then they're just bloody slaughtered. The Turks launch mass counterattacks and get more killed counterattacking after the 28th of June. Thousands get killed. That's why the fields were covered in Turkish corpses afterwards. But they're slaughtered. What's next? Well, we're definitely on dates now. The Battle of the 30th of June. What would you say happens then, if you're up?
I think they pushed forward, they captured some ground, but failed to do any better and didn't reach their objectives. I would imagine that's what happened.
Yeah, the French take the Quadrilateral. And it's just a sign of what's happening, that the French general, Henri Gourard, who's taken over from Damard. Sorry, we haven't got time to go to all that. But he's actually badly wounded. He's not hit by a shell, but he breaks his arm in 87 places, I think. And he eventually loses his arm. He ends up as a corps commander on the Western Front. His place is taken by General Maurice Bellew, who's 73 years old. He's already out there commanding 2nd Division. At least he knows what's going on. We're rattling through now because... to anybody logical, this is just bloody hopeless. Battle of 12th, 13th of July is next. And somehow, Hunter, Weston and Gouraud Hunter Weston and the French general. Sorry, I'm not sure which one it was at the time. They're going to use the 52nd Division who've just arrived. It's not funny, but they're going to use the 52nd Division.
You have to laugh, Pete, or you'd cry.
Yes.
I don't want people to think we're being flippant. You have to have an emotional outlet when you keep reading these things. It's just horrific.
Well, the 52nd Division are going to attack in the Achibaba Nullah area. That's next to the French. That means they can use the French artillery as well. Meanwhile, the French are going to try and take the last few trenches overlooking the Kerem's Dere. And they come up with the idea of splitting the attack into two parts so they can use more artillery. It also means the Turks can, but never mind. So the 155 Brigade would attack alongside the French at 7:35 in the morning, and the 157th Brigade to their left would attack separately in the afternoon at 16:50. The 155 Brigade attack, it has some success. They get forward, but then they get the first two lines, and then they think there's a third line, but they don't know where it is. And they start feeling their way forward. And it, when they get there, there is no line. It's just, the Turks have just marked out where the line will be. And what does Corporal Tom Richardson of the 1st 4th King's Own Scottish Borderers say, Matt?
He says, about 150 yards away, we could see the parapet of what looked like another trench. Accordingly, we doubled across in that direction, and on getting up to this third trench, we found it to be untenanted and only a couple of feet deep. However, it afforded us some cover, and in we scrambled, the order immediately coming along for every man to fill his two sandbags and build up the parapet. The ground was like flint, and we could make little headway with our entrenching tools. To the left from where I found myself, the shallow trench ran up towards a wood, and there seemed to be a great deal of rifle and machine gun fire coming in our direction from this wood. In front of us, however, there appeared to be no enemy at all. After about a half an hour, during which time we suffered numerous casualties, word was passed along to extend towards the wood. I got out and doubled across the open until I came to a very comfortable-looking shell hole, into which I very contentedly jumped. Very shortly after, I heard shouts of, "Retire! Retire!" I got back safely, crawling most of the way, as a shell burst very close, and I found I'd lost the power of one of my legs.
Now, that's the first attack. Come that afternoon, for 157th Brigade, they attack at 16:50. It's the same performance. They get forward, it's the same. They take the first two lines, they think there's a third line, and then they have to fall back and consolidate. And then absolute lunacy. What's left of the 1st Naval Brigade of the R&D, they're called into action and they move forward and they're going to attack next day alongside another French effort on the Kerem's Dere. Now, this is just insanity. So those two attacks have failed. So they're going to try again with a force that is absolutely knackered and depleted in strength. They're meant to go over the top at 16:30 on 13th of July. Pretty unlucky, 13th of July. And everything goes wrong. They reach the former Turkish front line and they find themselves in a man-made hell. But this is one of the great quotes, Matt. And this is why I like the Royal Naval Division so much. I call them the glitterati. All these posh officers of indeterminate sexuality, that's irrelevant to anything. But they're just very jolly. And this is Lieutenant Douglas Gerald, who wrote both the Hawk Battalion history and the Royal Naval Division history. And he was a card. He said this: "It was just indescribable. Just hundreds of men wandering about in the captured trench system in the burning sun, with corpses blackened and stinking lining the old Turkish firing steps. The sinister symmetry of their position being the only sign of any method at all." The redeeming feature of that occasion was A.P. Herbert's instructions to the sentries on his platoon frontage. "Remember, regard all Turks with the gravest suspicion." And that's laugh or cry. I mean, what's going on is not funny. You know, they're blackened corpses. Some of them are your mates, but that slightly supercilious. A.P. Herbert is a famous literary. He wrote various poems. It's very scatological. The counterattacks start, the artillery have to protect them, and one of the people protect, and people don't realise this, but the Australians are there, aren't they, Matt? They are there, because the artillery, the 1st Field Artillery Brigade are there throughout the campaign.
There wasn't enough space to land them at Anzac, so they sent them down to Helles, where they were more useful, and they were there. They did not fight at Anzac, they fought at Helles for the entire campaign. So there were still Aussies beavering away while the rest of the Anzacs were up back up at Anzac.
Beavering is a good expression, Matt. They're sweating blood. They're loading, and the guns get to be they always say the guns are red hot, white hot, whatever they are. But it's just an amazing quote you've got here from Corporal Ralph Doughty, 2nd Battery, 1st Field Artillery Brigade. What does he say?
Up at 4 a.m. this morning, Turks counterattacked in force and gave us particular hell with vengeance. We've just stopped firing for the third time this morning, and as far as we can find out, the ground gained yesterday has been held by our chaps. Had a glorious time. Started at 6:30 a.m., stopped firing at 9:10 p.m. Worked the old gun till the springs broke and the piece itself was so hot that the bearings expanded with the heat and stopped the recoil. We fired 1,160 rounds. My hands are burnt beautifully. Can hardly close my left. Got a whack on the knee, which put me off the gun for half an hour, but it's okay again. Heavy fighting all night. What a day. One of the hottest and best we've had. Have just repulsed a mass attack by the Turks. Can't close my right hand. Agony to right. We're all absolutely black with cordite smoke and dust. Like martyr to see me now. Gee, these Turks are some fighters. They counterattacked all night.
In the end, they hold the gains. But and the Turks have appalling losses, something like 9,800, nearly 10,000 losses, but their reserves are nearer and they're made up. But we lose a lot as well. The British lose 3,100 in these attacks and the French 840. And this triggers something interesting. It is an arguable thing that the French two divisions were the most competent military force on the peninsula. Because they had their artillery. The Turks didn't have much artillery. The French had their artillery. They were well trained. They performed well. But at this point, it's interesting. They fought for 10 weeks. And now they just can see it's hopeless. And they react in a very French manner. They go to the live and let live system. They just occupy their trenches. If the Turks attack them, they'll defend themselves. But they won't do anything else. They do little more for the rest of the campaign, and who can blame them? They've got the fire from Achibaba from the front, and then all the way along their right flank they've got the fire from across the straits. They're defeated. I think we've got to pay tribute to the French, right? So they give him in the end, but wow, what a fighting force they were. And if you've been to the French graveyard, it's big. And the French casualties are more than the Australians and New Zealanders put together. A lot more.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. I mean, what I like to say is that people forget that the French were there, but the people who forget the most about the French were the French themselves. Because ask a French person what the French contributed at Gallipoli, and they would not know what you're talking about. So we, as British and Australians, do a terrible job of remembering, but the French themselves do a worse job. It's understandable. They were dying in their tens of thousands on the Western Front at the same time and fighting in their homeland. So, of course, they were not going to be distracted by what was going on at Gallipoli. But it should be remembered the French fought and fought and bled until they could do no more and then stopped advancing at that point, which sensibly is what the British should have done well before as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pete, what's your summation of all this? We've gone through, six or seven battles. What's your summation of this fighting at hell is?
Well, I'm comparing it to Anzac again, but without any criticism of Anzac. That's a tale, and who tells it better than Bean? A tale of defensive actions, like on the 19th of May, skirmishes, patrols, leans, raid. You've got individual battalions, companies, every action detailed properly. And what a story it is of heroism to hold the Anzac Cove area. It's brilliant. But the real battle during those months, not throughout, but is fought tooth and nail at Helles. You've got whole divisions hurling themselves at each other time and time again on a front that's only 5,000 yards across. And yet you have core attacks, you have divisional attacks, again and again and again and again. And our listeners will get bored if I say it again for every major attack. And it truly was hell at Helles. And I think that it's an amazing story. It's a frustrating story. It's an annoying story, and it's upsetting.
Mate, the thing that sums it up for me better than anything else, if you wanted to look at the one statistic or the one fact that demonstrates what a disaster Gallipoli was, they're fighting these battles to capture the village of Krithia and the hill of Achibaba, which were their objectives for the first day. by the time they evacuated in January 1916, after 30 or 40,000 men had been killed and still lay out littered across the plain, they were still 2 kilometres short of those objectives for the first day. It was so wasteful, so bloody, just awful. You're right, it was hell at Helles. And, mate, thank you for sharing this terrible tale with us today.
Cheers, Matt.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.